Hello and welcome to the England Athletics podcast. Shortly, you'll hear from Tyree Donovan, the England senior 400-metre hurdles champion and guitar player who recovered from a serious injury last year to have his best ever season this year. Then, our CEO Chris Jones will join for a catch-up on how 2024 has gone and what the current challenges and priorities are in the sport. That's on the way, but first, Tyree Donovan describes what happened when he picked up that injury last year.
My back had slowly started to get a little bit more tense, and there was a training session where we just jogged over some hurdles, and suddenly it felt someone had wrapped a rope around my waist, tugged to me as if they were doing a tug of war. What we then later found out was I had a prolapsed disc. We started to see developments of my central nervous system starting to shut down. I was having, you know, elements of phantom limb, stuff which I couldn't believe was affecting my livelihood as much as it was at the time, because we were still thinking as a little training blip we could get over. But it was a big deal, and obviously we missed that last season and had to approach a meticulous recovery plan because of it.
Well, Tyree, it sounds really unusual and quite harrowing at the same time. What was the recovery process like?
I had options of taking surgery in October last year, 2023. That was where the big decision came in, because I knew in my mind, if I had the option to kind of take on the surgery, I was facing about 9 months out of recovery. So I had to make a decision as to think, would I take on the surgery and get my back fixed and not know what this season would bring? Or would I take on personal rehabilitation, self-sustained recovery, and see what could come out without having that facing 9 months out? Fortunately, by seeing what's happened obviously this year, I think I've been grateful to serve, made the right decision. But it was a very, very tough decision. I think obviously family and friends as well, they were very concerned about my livelihood. Still to this day, it's damaging me in ways which I still need to manage and be more knowledgeable on how I can kind of manage my day-to-day as opposed to training in the evenings as well. Not a lot of people had my back in. They did believe surgery was to be the right decision. But, you know, we pulled through, and I'm more than grateful for everyone around me because of that.
So following all this, you come into this year, and quite early in the season, you set a phenomenal PB, 49.23 seconds. Do you think because of what happened, you were even more determined to prove and deliver on your potential?
Yeah, I think that's something I've had kind of instilled to me. I've always been kind of in that top layer of podium places from the under-20s, under-23s, like top three. Been very grateful to share the track with Alex Nibbs and Chalmers. It's kind of like the main rivals over the years, and they had quite a bit more of a champion mindset, where I was always slightly in the shadow of that. And I think what developed from this situation was kind of a means of, what do I have to lose? I knew that I was committing to a process of what could happen to my body is either one end of the scale or the other. And that process of really being meticulous with my body, studying it from tip to toe, and being mindful of the consequences that can either be good or bad, would have an effect on my season. But I never had a doubt that I would be in a depressed or sort of saddened state by it, however the results would have gone, because I kind of went through this season knowing whatever happens, happens. And thankfully, you know, what's happened has been incredible.
The PB I mentioned that day was significant because it was a National Athletics League record and a best ever time, going all the way back to athletes in the 1960s. And the previous best time was set by Chris Rawlinson, GB Olympian in 1999. He ran it in the league. But the significance of all that must be pretty special.
It was special, Alex. And I think what made it more is that it was at my home club for Windsor. And they've had my backing since day one in the sport. I've been with them maybe 8 years now out of the 10 years I've been doing athletics. There's something about club athletics in general, which I think we haven't got enough appreciation from, you know, as a community, really. I think when you're in the sport and you've got staff or commentary teams, athletes, coaches, we understand the kind of grassroots fundamentals of this league. But the standards are getting better and better each year. That performance kind of showcased what can be done from anyone, really. Prior to that, I was running mid-50 points last year, which is you know, even still very respectable times, but to have a jump of that magnitude at your home club, first league match of the season, I think it really set the tone. And I was really happy to be a part of that history, especially when it's come to transitioning between an age group athlete coming into a more senior, having even just that opportunity to run at a level against seniors is really important. Clubs around England, you know, have a great importance of setting standards for what we can provide for younger athletes and what we can transition into more senior developments. So I think we need to be very grateful for the National League. People don't get many opportunities really when you get to senior as well to sort of establish themselves domestically.
So I suppose you must feel pretty buoyed for next year, especially as you did back up that one performance with a very similar time at the end of the summer at the Alexander Stadium.
No, for sure. And I think that was something I needed to find from my coach as well. We're trying to mature my running style, be more consistent. I have a very aggressive running style when it comes to 400 meter hurdles. You know, I tend to bolt out. And when I do that, when it comes to championship rounds as well, that can't be the best approach because, you know, I could burn myself out of heat, still get a win, but then I know I've got a semi or final to take on and, you know, I might not pull through it. I think that maturity is something I long to develop, and I've always had great people around me, such as Jesse Knight, Chris McAllister, Jacob Paul, who have been very prominent, established championship runners. I'm just a product of my environment. They have been, you know, almost like older siblings to me. So I'm an only child, so for them it feels like brother-sister kind of family when it comes to our training group, and I'm so grateful for their support over the years. It's been a massive part of who I am as an athlete and as a man.
How did you get into the training group and indeed the event that you're in now, the 400 meter hurdles?
So this definitely has to be of source from my coach, Marina Armstrong. I said, I've been with her since I was 16. I'm 25 now. Originally, I was a 100, 200 runner and a bit of triple jump as well. But me coming in at 16, about 6'5", I said to her, can I do the 400 meter flat? She said, look, you're going to have to get over some hurdles for me because a bit of waste, those long legs weren't obviously getting over them. So she has been my, you know, my rock in a hard place. Coaches probably don't get enough respect in the whole field of community of track. Like, they're always down there every single day, 6:30 p.m. in the evening, out in the cold, just doing what they got to do. They have so much array of knowledge. That's not even from an athlete perspective either. Like, the guidance she's given me as a person, I don't know much influence more I've had from one person outside of my mum and dad. There's not going to be many people who you come across in your life who are so dedicated to their craft that they want you to be the best you want to be as a person, as an athlete. You know, Marina Armstrong, hand on heart, is one of the best people I'm going to ever meet in my life because of it.
Well, as you say, coaches don't get enough plaudits, and she's certainly someone who would deserve many of those plaudits. Do you have any specific targets then for next year?
So next year we've got World Championships in Tokyo, haven't we? I think that's kind of the next step for me now, is to try and establish myself more so as a senior athlete in Europe. I now need to make that next step. And then obviously we've got the Commonwealth Games right around the corner in Glasgow. I've also been grateful to be put on the Senior Performance Programme of England Athletics for this next year. You know, they've been a massive support for me. Martin Rooney, Shani Palmer especially as well. They put their faith in me to know that there's something in there that I can work on and, you know, be a really good collaborative team member for England Athletics. So hopefully in the next 2 years, that will develop into more of the British athletic scene as well. And yeah, sky's the limit, really.
Yeah, the talent pathway, fairly recently announced by England Athletics, of course. How important is that to you?
That's been great. Really proud again for these honours because, you know, there's been so many athletes this year across the National Athletics League who have been outstanding, and to be in that category of recognition is something I do take to heart. It's really special.
Well, I'm sure your record in the NAL is one that Chris McAllister and F.A. Okoro will try and break next season. And obviously, yeah, in your training group, you've had Chris, who's a civil servant, and Jesse Knight, who's worked in teaching. What's your profession?
Yeah, so my studies and my profession differ quite a lot. So I originally did a English language and English literature degree at Brunel University, London. I did a master's in translation at University of Surrey. Main focuses were on Mandarin and Japanese. Majority of that creative side was a lot to do with my music. Been playing guitar for about a good 9-10 years, and wanted to develop my songwriting and go into sort of more creative industry scene. Coming into this now, I've become a data analyst at a utilities company in Leatherhead. My kind of day-to-day basis is making sure that the data and statistics of the energy provider up and down the country for water, gas and electric is all running well, and that we can all have, you know, a good winter, all cozy and not have to have too many power outages. So yeah, a lot of work in the engineering kind of sector, but I'm really enjoying it. A lot of diversity, what I've got with my studies and my profession, so I'm grateful.
Well, if it wasn't too cheesy, I'd say that the guitar playing gives many strings to your bow. How did you get into it?
Yeah, so the passion kind of started when I was a kid, really. I was learning classical guitar for maybe about 6 years at primary school, and then took it independently when I got to high school. And when I went into uni, I didn't have too much time to then play the guitar, but I had then more enough time to start writing. That writing then went into spoken word, and then did a few sort of open mics here and there in West London. I don't want to go into sort of a career as such of it, because I know it's so deeply embedded into what I love to do, that if I was to end up making a career out of it, I would almost feel pressured to think, am I really enjoying this now, or am I just doing this for work? I like to use it as an escape, really, from what happened to track. As much I have great passion and enthusiasm for sport, I felt like it was viable for me to have a balance of knowing there was something that I could get away from the sport if I was to get a big injury, or if I was to have something which was too intense, or there was too much pressure on the cards. But I take the sport very lightheartedly. I don't like to put too many pressure on myself, so I always available for my competitors, who I like to call my mates as well. You know, it's been great, and I think the music and the writing and the creative side of me has helped, you know, balance out the strategy and the pressures of the sport.
Has your guitar made it to a training camp or team bus?
It hasn't, no, it has actually. I'm looking forward to doing that maybe on the warm of a training camp with my training group. So no, that's brilliant, but yeah, I'll keep that to myself for now.
Rio Mitchum's, of course, got his musical talents, and
yeah.
Tell you what, back in the 70s and 80s, there were stories about guitars on the back of the team bus for those long trips around the country.
One thing I actually take from guitar really, and what I like to relate to hurdles, is the essence of getting rhythmical. And I feel like sometimes mentally, like, that could be a thing in the past, being very superstitious here, but obviously learning music, there is a rhythm you got to attain to, and I feel like when it comes to getting my stride pattern right and the fluidity and the essence that you need to carry yourself around the track is very much like music. So I'm very in depth and very aware of like how I keep my rhythm, and I think creatively that comes across in the sport as well. So I'm grateful for those two crossovers there.
That's Tyree Donovan, 400 meter hurdler, part of Marina Armstrong's group, and great to hear his story after that injury, smashing his personal best this year and taking more than a second off it. So, now joined by Chris Jones, and gives us a chance to reflect, first of all, on what's been a great season of success at the Olympic Games, and then, more recently, the Paralympics in Paris, but across many levels through the sport, from Keady Hodgkinson to Dan Pembroke, who we had on the podcast right after he won. So what have you made of this year?
Yeah, brilliant, wasn't it? Wonderful to see quite a few athletes that have come through the English talent pathway perform for Great Britain and Northern Ireland in Paris in the Olympics and Paralympics. Phoebe Gill, just wonderful to see her make her debut on that biggest stage of all. Max Bergin, good to see him back to full fitness and competing again. George Mills, Molly Cauldry, some great performances, of course. Georgia Bell, return to athletics is well documented. Great lesson, if you like, that is, in terms of never giving up, coming back in at 30, recognising it's a late development sport, and that could serve as an inspiration to other athletes as well. So well done to her, and well done to Trevor and Jenny, the coaches. Of course, to Keely Hodgkinson, just marvellous performance. KJT, some of the relay performances. You know, it was great, great summer. But also English athletes competing well in the European under-18s and then domestically, you know, whether that be at English schools, track and field championships, the England Athletics revised outdoor track and field championships over two weekends, the Friday to Sunday. long events, of course, but we felt it was the right approach to free up some dates in the calendar in what is a cluttered summer season to allow more space. And we thought it worked well at Alexander Stadium, so we'll repeat that in 2025. Plethora of other competitions. I've mentioned English schools, but also the school games in Loughborough in a very innovative format with field events on the Friday, track on the Saturday, and a myriad of league competition at a national, regional, local level. Great summer in many respects.
So looking ahead, we often talk about how we need to innovate and there are priorities to focus on. What are they at this point after a successful summer?
Well, consistent with previous conversations we've had, you know, we're 3 or 4 years on post-pandemic and the trends have not changed in terms of off-track running, multi-terrain running, returning somewhere to where we were pre-pandemic. Numbers are good. So most of the growth in our sport is from the over 30s off-track runners. One of our largest growing age segments in the England Athletics family are the over 50s and over 60s. So the off-track running picture is healthy with over 3,000 licensed events supported by England Athletics each year. We're not quite back to the near 4,000 events that we were licensing pre-pandemic, but off-track running seems to be going well. Run events managed by Barry Hopkins, which of course, as many will know, has replaced Run Britain. So England Athletics responsible for that. But the picture in track and field is more worrying. The numbers were declining pre-pandemic and they've further declined post-pandemic. As a result of that, of course, we've commissioned a wider track and field review, which the four home countries are working collaboratively on. That's fundamentally important, not just looking at aspects such as age groups, but also competition organisation, delivery, travel time, the whole athlete experience, what happens in clubs, what happens, of course, in terms of coaching, how do we best transition youngsters from junior to senior participation and then performance levels as well. The other focus, of course, is making sure that the management of the age group transition takes place effectively through to April the 1st, 2026, when the new age groups come in, when we go from odds to even age groups. So that's effectively 13s, 15s, 17s, 14s, 16s, 18s. Bringing us in line with many other parts of the world, but also recognising the current age groups effectively mean that you're competing at the top of your age group at the same time you do in GCSEs or your A-levels respectively. So we're listening to athletes, parents, coaches. We're making that change as home country, supported by UK Athletics, effective on April the 1st, 2026. Technical details have already been launched to enable competition providers and clubs to make those necessary changes. Competition conference on the 14th of December in Birmingham that we're hosting. We expect a number of competition providers to be there to come and talk about how they're planning to adapt. Using this as a kind of seminal moment, if you like, to use age group change as an opportunity to look at how the overall competition is organised and run. And yeah, I think there's an opportunity in 2025, of course, to start trialling, piloting, testing some of those approaches ahead of 26.
We obviously saw some changes to the competition calendar this year, including the 3-day events. There was an idea to bring in a bit of innovation and excitement around the whole competition weekend, wasn't there?
Yes, and you know, I've always believed that England Athletics bodies in our privileged position should be leading from the front. Of course, people aren't always going to agree with you, but there is a consensus that when it comes to competition and track and field, we have some challenges, so we need to take action. Otherwise, you just keep doing the same thing in the same way and expect different results. You're going to be disappointed, but they are challenging decisions. And I was excited by the introduction of the inaugural club relay championship this summer in partnership with Birchfield Harriers at the Alexander Stadium. We'll repeat that again in 2025. And I think the number of clubs taking part across different age groups in those different relay events at that championship will grow. I think relays are extremely exciting. There's a real team ethos to it, and it brings people together. Of course, on the biggest stage, there are medals up for grabs. Relays are part and parcel of national, area, regional, county, local events as well. And I think there's an opportunity to really grow interest in relays as well. So we're trying to give that more prominence. And Manchester International will be back in 2025. And we're just working with the home countries at the moment to revisit other international opportunities for other age groups. So yeah, lots to look forward to, but no room for complacency. There are a number of things that are not working as optimally as we want them to in the sport. Track and field is a concern. We need to get more coaches, more officials into the sport, try and transition more individuals through that pathway to improve their experience, their quality of what's being delivered, to provide a better service to athletes. And ultimately, performances will be positively affected in that way. Definitely more work we need to do in the coaching and official space.
Yeah, we'll come on to that in a second. As you mentioned there, some events for next year. The calendar is out for next season. Just give us a flavour of what's come up in the more immediate term, the shorter term.
Of course, there's a myriad of road running and off-track events now taking us forward to the end of this calendar year and into the new year. And then, of course, we're into indoor track and field season again. I think our first event starting in January in Sheffield, and that's where we host our indoor championships. And then we'll be back into the spring where, of course, we've got the road relays again in Sutton Park, and then into the outdoor track and field season with, of course, county champs at the start of May, which often marks the seminal moment in the outdoor track and field season. And we're back into silly season again, you know, activities going on across the country throughout through to September. So quite cyclical, our sport, isn't it? It's established in terms of what happens and where, but it takes a huge voluntary effort to support. Volunteering is part and parcel of our sport. It's a fantastic, selfless effort that we're all very, very grateful for.
Yes, let's therefore use that as a segue to talk more about some of our volunteers, including coaches and officials that you touched on there a moment ago. But yes, there's been obviously some honesty that there's been a reduction in officials since the pandemic. There's been a push to get more coaches in through various pathways, including some high-level athletes who've stepped into becoming coaches. Jenny Meadows would be one that you've already mentioned. So what is the focus in this area?
Well, first, I must say congratulations again to Trevor and Jenny. They are standard bearers, really, for coaches coming into the system for the first time, looking at and saying, right, how should I operate? Where can I go for best practice? Obviously, Jenny, an esteemed athlete in her own right. Trevor worked for England Athletics at one stage, and UK Athletics, obviously, in a performance remit, was a club athlete, always open to sharing their ideas, their thoughts on the sport, and trying to help people. And we need as many people as Trevor and Jenny to inspire the next generation. But you're right, 1 year on from the coaching and officials transfer from UK Athletics to EA in terms of licensing. And just to remind people, we license all the coaches in England now, and we license the officials from level 1 to 3. UK deals with the top 2 inches, if you like, of technical officiating. And we've been looking to introduce small but important changes to qualifications. We have noticed that the number of people coming through our courses generally is slowly going up, which is good. And we're licensing more people. We managed to successfully transfer the licensing system this time last year, with the majority of people relicensing from UK to EA. We set up a coach education management group, an officials education management group, that are working really well. And one of the important things that we've done is commission a review of the pathway for coaches and officials. So we're reviewing our coaching strategy, looking at qualifications, and also looking at the non-qualification-based support to coaches in our sport. I think we're around 21,000 coaches and leaders in England. At this time, around 4,000 technical officials. That number fluctuates according to when people need to renew licenses or when they qualify in license. We're assured by the progress made, but there's lots of work that we need to do. I think that inevitably is going to require further investment to improve qualifications, make sure we've got the right people delivering both our coaching and officials courses, but also get a good blend between online delivery and face-to-face delivery, and investing in technology as well. You know, there's a lot of pressure on those individuals for their time. We have to embrace flexibility, remove bureaucracy where it exists, and broaden and deepen the base, get more people into the system to have the opportunities to dip in and dip out of that learning experience as they see fit, as time allows. So we need to move with the times. We're working in a competitive environment where people's time is precious. We're competing with other sports. So we need to make sure that we're always focusing on how we can fine tune the pathways and make them as best as they possibly can be. And we're not where we need to be yet.
On a positive note, though, things are looking pretty good with regards to the Commonwealth Games. We have some dates between 23rd of July and 2nd of August 2026. We know these will be a scaled back games, but athletics being a compulsory sport within the games, things look as though they're going to bode pretty well.
Yeah, we're all delighted. Obviously, the Commonwealth Games are returning to Glasgow in 2026. Obviously, 2014, Glasgow hosted the Games before, so they know what to expect, despite the Games being a kind of reduced model, if you like. But it's great that athletics is one of the two statutory sports, I think, alongside swimming. We're yet to hear what the format will look like, stadia layout, logistics and all that stuff, and how many athletes we'll get to take to the Games. Traditionally, we have received funds from Sport England to help us to put in place a management team, a leadership team to prepare the athletics team in the best possible way to battle for medals. That information is kind of being provided gradually to us, but it's a great aspiration for young English athletes, maybe those on our youth or junior talent pathway, to really have something to aim for. Phoebe Gill competed in Paris this summer at age 17. So those athletes, it's not inconceivable that there will be athletes, of course, competing for England in the Commonwealth Games in 2026. So really excited by it.
And do you think securing this edition goes some way to helping with the long-term future of the Games, or is it too early to say at this point?
I think it's too early to say, but certainly it can't hurt, can it? It's obviously great to see that there is a nation, there is a city that has faith in the Commonwealth Games, that have been prepared to put themselves forward and say, yeah, we'll host this. We know exactly what benefits it will bring to us as a country, as a city. And also, of course, the athletes. We've been very clear. We think Commonwealth Games is fundamentally important in terms of athlete development, progression. It is an elite competition. And ultimately, it's in some regards, it could be considered a stepping stone competition for those athletes have aspiration to then compete on the bigger stage at the Olympics and Paralympics in the future, who might be on their journey. I can think of numerous athletes. Andy Turner springs to mind, actually, who won a gold medal in Delhi 2010 and then went on, obviously, to great success after that. Leon Baptiste won a gold medal in Delhi in 2010 as well. Athletes then progressed in their athlete journey prior to, obviously, them retiring, and in Leon's position, obviously a high achieving coach now as well. So yeah, I think there are so many reasons why Commonwealth Games is important.
Right, we've also got some regional council elections coming up. What's happening regarding those?
So biennial elections, so every 2 years we look to re-elect, in some cases, existing councillors to the regional council structure of England Athletics. And just to briefly give an example of what regional councils do, there are 9 regional councils across 9 English regions. They are a constituent representative body, if you like, the voice of the clubs at regional level. And they help to shape strategy that is set by the Board of England Athletics, but also important decisions such as affiliation fees for clubs and member bodies, athlete registration fees annually. And also they were fundamental to the decision-making process around aspects such as age groups, competition, etc., earlier this year and last year. So they also make the decisions on the regional volunteer awards, award winners and finalists every 12 months. Every 2 years, we look to re-elect people back into their council seats, but also elect new councillors onto the 9 regional councils across the country. And we need a broad representation of background in sport across, obviously, track and field, road running, cross-country, multi-terrain, but also people who bring coaching experience, technical officiating experience, and generic club leadership experience as well to bring to the table. Gender balance is very important, mixture of youth and experience, ethnic diversity, Paralympic representation as well. If people are interested in becoming a councillor, then please put yourselves forward as part of the regional council elections. The process kicks off during November with advertising and promotion. And then in the early part of 2025, people submit themselves forward for election. And then the election results are disclosed in April, start of April. So speak to people in your club or local clubs to see if you can canvass support, because you need some support to put yourself forward. Feel free to reach out, speak to an existing regional councillor in your region about what it entails. But yeah, more the merrier.
Brilliant. Yeah, just to mention, obviously, in the last podcast, we heard from Marilyn Okoro, obviously, you know, different to a regional council, but has been on the England Athletics board and was talking about, yeah, the importance of bringing in athlete experience to that, as well as diversity. So, yeah, it was quite interesting to hear her reflections on being a board member and just generally someone who is carving a different life for herself post-retirement and still staying involved in the sport.
Yeah, and vitally important that we get perspective of recently retired athletes involved with the governance of our sport, because you go back to some of the challenges I referenced earlier, particularly track and field participation, retention and growth amongst teenagers into senior levels of participation in our sport. You know, getting that perspective from recently retired athletes, fundamentally important. What experience did they have? What are their outlooks on innovation and competition? What worked well for them? What didn't work well? The world is a very different place than we know from what it was even 5 years ago. Things keep changing. Things keep evolving. We've got two options. You can keep doing the same things, in some cases averagely, and as I said earlier, expect different results and be disappointed. Or we can embrace change, move forward, and take some calculated risks, in some cases, some sensible risks, and be bold. Ultimately, what better legacy is there for all of us to leave than put in place the foundations for other generations to enjoy our great sport moving forward? And so, yeah, it's great that someone like Marilyn is involved, but also other athletes that put themselves forward as part of the EA athlete panel that we set up over the last 12 months, led by Beck Bennett. I know at a regional level, a lot of the regional councils are looking at forming their own regional athlete panels as well to input to council decision-making. I think the Northeast have set something up and others will probably follow. So, yeah, fantastic.
Well, thanks very much to Chris for joining as always. Hope you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, and we'll be back before the end of the year with more. Don't forget to keep an eye out on our website for announcements regarding some of the things that Chris mentioned, including regional council elections and various calendar updates and championship news. Also, plenty to watch out for on our social media channels. For now, though, thanks for listening and goodbye.